Hello and welcoming you on October the 29th, 2024, the 35th birthday of Primož Roglič, the 95th anniversary of Black Tuesday, and the first baby shower of the 2025 Tour de France, if baby shower is more apt than, I don't know, baptism or something else. My name is Daniel Freiber, and over the next hour or so, I'll be pronouncing, if not on the gender of that 2025 Tour de France parcours, then at least on its nature, its charm, its likelihood of inflicting buffalo grill dinners on its roving reporters, and more besides. In the most adjacent co-pilot's berth today is the only man on earth whose retirement from the tour was, for a while at least, a bigger will he won't he cliffhanger than Mark Cavendish's currently is. He is François Tourmazur. François, what do you make of the fact that Mark Cavendish just won't spit it out? I saw again today in Paris, he was asked on the stage whether he will indeed make a comeback, and he just can't bring himself to put us out of our misery.
Yeah, he said we...
Anyway, hello, François.
Hello. Hello, guys. Yeah, he said, we'll see. And he looked like, you know, he had this little... He made a face like, you know, his kind of childish, bratty face, like, you know, just wait and see. We're going to Châteauroux, so that might be a clue. Is he also going for the you know, fourth stage victory in Châteauroux? He might, well, looking at the tour... parcours, he would probably you know, give up after Châteauroux. But no, yeah, as you say, I mean, you know Cavendish, Mark Cavendish, better than I do. But I don't know. Will he do the tour?
Yes, I think he will not. I'm pretty certain that he will not do the tour. I'm actually more uncertain whether you'll do the tour. But this is what you should have been doing for the last 5 years, François, just teasing, titillating us all by saying, on verra, we'll see, every time we ask you whether you will return for an encore, another Tour de France.
Well,
Yeah, skipping ahead to we'll Châteauroux, in fact. Skipping ahead to Châteauroux, I've got notes for the stage. We're going to go through all the stages later for the 2025 tour route. And for that particular stage, stage 9, Chinon to Châteauroux, in my notes I've got snooze fest. Only wind or a Cavendish comeback can save us. Anyway, alongside François and me, or at least playing I Spy in the back seat, it's young Richard Abraham, who of course was part of our on-the-ground Tour de France crack team in 2024. Richard, how are you
doing?
Hello,
I'm good, thank you. Good to see you both. Yeah, all I could picture was slightly dodgy Airbnbs and long transfers when I was seeing that route. It all came flashing back, especially the that montage that they put together, ASO, you know, looking back of the highlights of this year's tour. Just gone.
I think François is currently in a bit of a dodgy Airbnb. I was slightly concerned about your appearance on this week's podcast because you announced that you were attending the presentation of the tour and then you were going to have a bit of a reunion with some old chums, some old colleagues afterwards. I feared a bit of a boozy lunch. I asked you when we were arranging your appearance on the podcast whether you're going to be, as the French say, drunk like a Polish man. That's not a racist slur, that's a French idiomatic expression. But you seem to be sober as a judge, François, and ready to go.
Yeah,
did you have a nice lunch? Did you have a nice lunch?
I did have a nice lunch, but I can name the place because it's just across the road. Everybody who's gone to the tour presentation know the place called the Congress. And the place where the tour presentation takes place is the Palais des Congrès. So, well, obviously the bar and the place is named after the venue. But yeah, you know, the food was great, but we had kind of like a couple of glasses of wine, and then everybody seemed to, you know, to have enough, and we parted. So the tradition of long boozy lunches to discuss the course after the tour presentation seems to belong to the past. So another reason for not to return on the Tour de France, as far as I'm concerned.
Very sad. No gitan was smoked. Nothing like that.
That's long gone.
What happened? Where did Christian Poiret, François, go? The chap who was he's the president of the Nord Département.
He looked
great fun, and he said we know how to party. That was his summary of the tour coming to the north. Of like, we don't have hills, we don't have beautiful scenery, but we know how to party. We have beer and frites, I think he said, didn't
he? Yeah, exactly. No, he was actually the star of the show. I think that the best moment of the presentation was this man, Christian Poiret, you're right. My impression is he was invited to the official cocktail, which is the place where the booze was happening, but being, you know, semi-retired, I was uninvited. But I would have loved to know this guy better, because as you said, he really stole the show.
We were going to get onto it later, but we've got a lot to get through talking about the stages, so we might as well broach this now. Just the event itself, before we started recording today, I said that it's broadly the same every year. There's a little less sparkle dust than there used to be because of the absence of some of the big stars, particularly the defending champions, both of the Tour de France avec, the women's Tour de France, and the men's Tour de France. Pogacar and Nibia Doma were not in attendance. But apart from that, broadly what we see every year, in my intro to today's episode, I likened it to a baby shower. Could we have something a bit more like a baby shower? It just sort of pop, I don't know, where Christian Prudhomme sort of whacks a piñata or something and the tour route flies out onto the stage, or can we sort of spice this up, sex this up, this event?
As I said, you know, before we started the pod, I mean, they said that they didn't have the big stars because the tour presentation this year was 2 weeks later than usual, and Pogacar, Vingegaard, and all the other guys, you know, have gone on holidays and couldn't be there. As for the change of, like most other things, and you've been to other, you know, Grand Tour presentations, the real star of the tour presentations presentation, as far as ASO are involved, are the sponsors, you know. So all the big companies that are partners with ASO have all their, you know, best staff there. There's a couple of politicians. So it's not meant to be, how could I say, to be either glamorous or exciting. It's meant to please the people with the money. The big change that might happen in the future is that, as you know, the MC of the tour presentation for the past 20 years has been Philippe Sudre, who was the who writes, you know, Christian Prudhomme speeches, but Philippe Sudre is the same age as me, and we're retiring together. So next year he won't be, you know, he wouldn't be in charge of it. So that there might be something different. There was a major difference that I've seen along the years during the tour presentation. Jean-Étienne Amaury, ASO's big boss, the first speech he made at the tour presentation was really awkward. He was really, really clumsy and uncomfortable. He was much more comfortable this year, and he seems to improve with every year. Well, he still, you know, made a huge mistake by saying that Binyam Girma was the first African to win the Tour de France stage, but you know, he's improving, so there's a bit of hope.
It wasn't quite a Trump rally. Francois, has the presentation of the tour route ever had an evening sort of prime time slot and been broadcast live on France Télévision with a sort of variety dimension to it? Because this has happened with the Giro presentation. It's been on Rai television with a bit more sort of razzmatazz, maybe some live singing, a bit more sort of X Factor to it. Has that ever happened with the Tour de France presentation?
No. I mean, in the old days, like, you know, we'll be talking about tours of the past, because obviously this Tour de France is looking to the past. I mean, it's very like retro, as we say. I remember my first tour presentation with Félix Lévitin in 1987, I think it was. It was only journalists, like 200 of us in a small venue. No TVs or nothing, so it was just, you know, just more like a press conference. And it's actually evolved just a little bit above the status of press conference. The difference being all the sponsors, as I said. If you're looking for a big show with the glamour and the bling aspect of things, you should have looked, you know, and many people were there, the same people were there. The night before, we had the Ballon d'Or, you know, the Golden Ball ceremony with Sepp Piquet, you know, the Tour de France speaker, acting as an MC and asking questions.
Oh, really?
Yeah, was there.
Yeah. The Ballon d'Or.
So a lot of the guys who were in charge of the tour presentations ceremony this year, you know, looked a little bit tired from being at the Ballon d'Or the night before. So there you are.
Does this mean Seb is now sworn enemy of all Real Madrid fans? Probably.
He probably is.
Anyway, chaps, much more about the Tour de France presentation later on. We're going to have a sort of ad hoc, ad-libbed news roundup of sorts in the off-season. It's going to be a bit more of a sort of buffet arrangement. No, we're not really going to respect any sort of hierarchy of importance in the news roundup. We're just going to sort of pick what we've noticed over the last week to talk about. Anything that has caught our eye. But this week, there has been some extremely important news. Our great mate, Larry Warbass, the Motown maestro, currently of Agir d'Auxerre, or Decathlon Agir d'Auxerre La Mondiale, I should say, has finally landed himself a contract for next year. He'll be running for Tudor Pro Cycling in 2025, Swiss Pro Conti team. They announced Larry's signature amid much fanfare last week. I actually sent Larry a voicemail message asking him whether he would regale us with a voicemail message of his own, just talking about how happy he is to join Tudor and how the move come about. But I think Larry is on holiday at the moment in Singapore, if I'm not mistaken, and he hasn't replied to me yet. However, I'm sure we'll be hearing from the Motown Maestro in the next few weeks about that move to Tudor. Very good news. A lot of people are very happy about that. I know. A lot of the listeners have been unhappy and have made it known. And a lot of people in the UK have been unhappy about some other news in the last week. And on a personal note, this news is basically me losing my job. Warner Brothers Discovery announced last week that they will be the exclusive broadcaster of the Tour de France in the United Kingdom after 2025 and up to 2030. Of course, the current live broadcaster in the UK is a terrestrial television network called ITV, and I happen to work for them. They have been broadcasting the Tour de France. Well, this would have been the 25th year, if I'm not mistaken. And the Tour de France has been broadcast live on terrestrial British television every year since the 1980s, before ITV, it was Channel 4. Of course, obviously, I've got a big vested interest here, chaps. I'll give you my thoughts in just a moment, but I'll ask you first. Richard, your reaction to this?
I think like a lot of listeners, not just because I'm of my age, but like a lot of listeners, the ITV coverage was my gateway into seeing cycling, following cycling and getting into the sport, because it was free to air. I was a teenager and it was those like 7 p.m. highlights immediately following the stage that was the way in. And I think it is sad that it's not in the future going forward going to have that same presence on free to air. I think it's a shame for the sport that it doesn't have that reach and that ability to communicate in the way that it did. And I think as well, there was something, it did get me thinking about like watching TV and the whole experience of watching television and consuming media has changed, hasn't it? In the way that everything's sort of subscription based or much more subscription based or on demand now. And the idea of sort of sitting down and watching something that's on at a given time and knowing that you're watching it with a lot of other people was actually something that I felt quite, was quite sort of...
Well, this is a hugely relevant point, maybe the most relevant point. I'll say my piece in a minute, but you know, have been a lot of people lamenting that this is not going to, what was once available is no longer going to be available. But what you said about people consuming broadcast media differently. I was looking at some statistics about watching broadcast TV, terrestrial TV in the UK. There have been lots of statistics on this. A recent study, I think it was Ofcom, showed that children aged 4 to 15, among children aged 4 to 15, only 55% are watching any broadcast television every week in 2023, compared to 81% in 2018. Now, in 5 years, 6 years, it has absolutely nosedived the proportion of children, of young people who watch any kind of terrestrial broadcast
and TV. That's the context, isn't it? Is that, like in most countries, I imagine, the budgets for those terrestrial networks are not what they used to be, and there is not the money there to just dish it out to stuff, which is, cycling is still a niche sport. And did you and Rob discuss this last week, maybe, or it was on the Kilometre Zero you guys did, talking about the sort of future of the sport, and how much growth there might be for cycling. And I think in the next 5 years or whatever we're talking about for the contract that WBD have signed with ASO, cycling isn't going to, it's unlikely to become as big as the big global sports, is it? So I guess that's the background to it. And I think it will still be there. It's not like nobody can watch the coverage of the Tour de France in this country anymore. But I think what and you're a big part of this, Daniel, but what ITV's offering was different to Eurosport Discovery. And that's not to say one was better or one was worse. They were different and they catered for a different audience. And I think it's a shame that there isn't that, there won't be that difference going forward, because I do think there's an audience for both. I mean, that was probably proven by, I don't know the audience figures, but certainly I enjoyed having access to both. So I think that's a shame.
Yeah, I guess that's what happens to a country that's not a traditional cycling country. Because as you probably know, I think it's part of the European law, actually. Well, you're not in Europe. I mean, Britain is not in Europe anymore, but at least in the European Union. But there are a number of protected sports events that have to be free to air, that are protected events. In France, the Olympic Games, the Football World Cup, the Euro, the Tour de France, I think the French Open, have to be broadcast on a free-to-air channel. It's part of the, it's legal, you know. That's obviously not the case in Britain, but in France, you have access to Eurosport and to many other, pay-per-view channels, but the Tour de France is protected and will always be, unless the law changes. But it will always be on a free-to-air channel. As you said, especially to provide the show of, to make sure these events are shown to people who are not interested in the sport. What I'm saying is that, as you say, Richard, if you go to Eurosport or if you go to a pay-per-view channel, it's because you like the sport already. So you're not going to make new fans if started to like cycling or any other sport because we came across this sport on a free-to-air channel. These days, there will be less chances for kids, I suppose, to stumble upon a sport they don't know about. You see what I mean?
I agree with you, Francois, to an extent, but I think what the sort of executives of these streaming networks would contend is that young people now, their gateway drug is no longer necessarily that free-to-air, for example, coverage of the Tour de France. It's generally bite-sized clips on social media, and that is the gateway. That is why they would say we shouldn't be too concerned that young people are not going to be able to watch 4-hour live broadcasts of the Tour de France free to air. That they will find another way into it. I mean, yeah. On the other hand, you think about professional cycling. There were quotes in, I think, L'Équipe last week. Marc Madiot in L'Équipe talking about how cycling has become a rich person's sport, and there are access to cycling is difficult from that point of view as well, from a financial point of view. And if you add in you know, a streaming, a paid streaming service, then obviously it compounds, it could compound that particular problem. Obviously, I've got very sort of mixed feelings, complicated feelings about this. On the one hand, I'm sort of set to lose my job and to lose the opportunity to work with a fantastic team of people, extremely talented people that I've been working with since 2016. And I'm immensely, immensely grateful that I got that opportunity because, just rubbing up alongside professionals like sort of Gary Imlach and Ned Bolting and David Miller and also, you know, the people who obviously, the sort of 15 or so people who work in France for the most part, apart from the COVID editions, behind the scenes, the technical people, you know, it's just been an immense privilege. We've had a good run. ITV's had a good run. Channel 4 had a good run before it, and all things come to an end. But yeah, I do sort of wonder as well whether the backdrop of British cycling not thriving in the way it was a few years ago has had an influence. That there is this narrative out there that ITV didn't bid at all. That might be true, but I don't think you should read into that. ITV weren't interested, wouldn't have wanted the live broadcast. I think it's much more likely that they were not able to afford it. You know, the financial realities were different, and I think that's probably the case here.
And just before we recorded, I saw a story on the Guardian reporting exactly the same issue with cricket in this country. In that, as far as I understand it, the ECB, the England and Wales Cricket Board, who is responsible for the television rights for international and national cricket involving the England team, those international matches will no longer be on free to air for exactly the same reason. It's not that those free to air channels didn't bid for it. It's just they were nowhere near the ballpark for what the ECB wanted. And that was something I was reminded of. Francois, you talked about it already, but when you watch Jean-Étienne Amaury get up on stage and give these slightly awkward speeches, and I noticed that he mispronounced Pogacar. did you get that as well? I don't mean to like bash Jean-Étienne at all here, but I'm really reminded of the fact that it is a business, right? And there's that book, isn't there, Le Freak, about the, you know, the whole history of Amaury Sports Organization, and the it's a private company and it is interested in generating money. And it's TV rights are a big way that it does that, isn't it? And it's a reminder that it is a business first and foremost. And the nostalgia of hearing that ITV theme tune ring out again and, you know, reminding you of your youth is not really part of that picture.
Yeah. As I said to my colleague Matt Rendell on a text yesterday, we're about to be consigned to the nation's collective memory bank like Arctic Roll and cream soda. Unfortunately, that's just our fate. But yeah, one more year of ITV on the Tour de France. Anyway, a couple of other things to mention. Probably haven't got time to go into this in great detail, Francois, but I did. I thought of you. I often think of you, Francois, but I thought of you at the weekend when France Radio unveiled, they presented this expose into the current state of professional cycling vis-a-vis doping amid much fanfare. And they presented this in various forms. There was a clip, a sort of little film on social media, sort of 4 or 5 minute film with a narrator, which sort of laying out the findings of their investigation. And there was also stories on their websites and I guess reports on the radio as well. And the sort of bottom line, well, the bottom line was that professional cyclists, in their view, are currently abusing a vast arsenal of, and this is the important bit, authorized products like caffeine, paracetamol, theophylline and muscle relaxants. Now, I thought of you, Francois, because you often say, and I completely agree with you, that doping is a legal issue and not a moral issue. And it often seems to me, unfortunately, in Francois, particularly in France, there's a certain cohort of I would call them almost misanthropic journalists who seem very invested in peddling the idea of cycling being a rotten, drugs-addled world in the same way that it certainly once was, but I don't believe still is. As I said, all of the products mentioned and the credibility of these reports, these kind of comment pieces, investigations, to my mind, completely goes out the window when they start talking about ketones and decrying the fact that people are using ketones, which are now a commercially available product that anyone can buy on the internet and are completely legal. I don't think it really does. I think it kind of gives journalism a bit of a bad name when things are spun like this.
Yeah, no, I agree. I repeat what I always said, as you said. I mean, if it's legal, it's not doping, and the rest is bullshit.
But beautifully concise. Beautifully concise. Yeah.
More generally, there is a tendency now, not only in sports, to confuse morality and legality. There are two different things, and because the notion of morality, is different to every individual in different countries, in different classes, in different religions, and that's precisely why there is a legality. I mean, law has been invented and created, and justice has been created so that you can draw a line, that kind of satisfies or dissatisfies the various moral points of view.
And Francois, it's not fair to leave to put the burden of deciding what is right and what is wrong upon the athletes. That is why we do have bodies like, WADA with the WADA code, who decide that on their behalf. As soon as you move everything into a moral realm and start using terms like the former director of the French anti-doping agency, Jean-Pierre Verdi, did at the weekend, he said, this is like authorized doping. As soon as you start sort of introducing those gray areas, then you're asking the riders to come up with their own morality, and it all becomes very, very difficult.
I'll tell you something. Food is authorized doping because it improves your performances, So eating is authorized doping. Drinking is authorized doping, because you take something extra from your body and it improves your performance. So that's bullshit once again.
Chaps, happier news. At the weekend, the British Cycling Federation, where they held their annual awards dinner, and our late great colleague and co-founder Richard Moore was inducted into the Hall of Fame alongside some very illustrious names: Ed Clancy, Dame Laura Kenny, Jason Kenny, Sir Jason Kenny, that should be, Sinead Reid, Joe Rousell, Danny Rowe, Sir Bradley Wiggins, among the best well-known of those inductees. But fantastic honour for Richard and for his family. I know they were very proud and very much deserved as well, in light of all the different contributions that Richard made to cycling in the UK, not least as a rider, of course. he would be sort of poking us, prodding us at this point, urging us not to forget that. And I was amused on his behalf, but also pleased that in the little sort of biographies that British Cycling published on their website upon the announcement of this induction, and they did actually include a few details about his racing career, including that memorable, I think they mentioned the Tour of Langkawi in about 1998 that he rode. So that was some very nice news, as I say, we're all very proud. Finally, well, I think that concludes actually the news round. I've got Wout van Aert dressed as a squirrel here, chaps. Do we want to comment on
I've
that?
I've got that too. I don't know, what is there to say, really?
What is there
that
to say
Wout van Aert
about
didn't
that?
Say?
I tell you what, there is something to say. I've got something to say, and I made a mental note to myself to try and think of an answer to this question, but I didn't before we started recording. Which cyclist would you like to see? Because we've had Nairo Quintana now in the equivalent program in Colombia. Was he in a, was it some kind of lizard or crocodile suit? We've had Van Aert as a squirrel. Which rider would you like to see? You could have any rider in the world in any animal costume. Any thoughts?
I think Mark Soler
would is a great candidate for this
show.
What
would you dress him up as?
I don't know if it, I'm going to come to that. I heard a good story about Mark Soler a couple of weeks ago, a very sort of heartwarming story about Mark Soler. Apparently he's a very generous chap and very well liked by the UAE staff. And at the Grand Départ of the Tour de France in Bilbao, he turned up with a huge jamón ibérico, a huge ham, you know, Spanish ham, and I think maybe some wine, maybe some other sort of delicacies. And he just presented all of the UAE staff with this for their enjoyment over the course of the 3.5 weeks. You know, we hear about riders thanking staff post hoc for the job they've done on Grand Tours, but Marc Soler was sort of thanking them in advance and made this lovely gesture. So maybe those pigs that eat the black acorns, that would be Marc Soler.
I think we could hit kill two birds with one stone here and sort of liven up the tour presentation by dressing up.
The decathlon
riders don't have to wear those sort of school blazers that they had to wear today with the little badges on them. They can dress up in animal outfits. And
that is the answer, yeah. Richard. Well,
and the badger is already taken, as you know.
There we go. There we go.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast, team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Indeed. When it comes to hiring people for your organisation, perhaps the best way to find the right candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match instead using Indeed. If you're hiring, the search can be over as quickly as you start with Indeed, because it's a matching and hiring platform with more than 350 million monthly visitors. Matching technology can help you find the top quality candidates more quickly. So instead of going through the process of scheduling and screening and messaging, Indeed can match you with the best possible candidates very quickly. And it's not just about the speed, it's about finding the perfect match. 75% of employers say that Indeed delivers the highest quality candidates compared to other online job sites. And listeners to the Cycling Podcast can get a £100 sponsored job credit by going to indeed.com/cycle. You'll get your jobs more visibility. Just go to indeed.com/cycle right now, and you'll also be helping to support the Cycling Podcast by saying that you heard about Indeed right here. So indeed.com/cycle is where you need to go. Terms and conditions apply. And in the minute and a half or so I've been speaking to you about Indeed, more than 30 hires have been made on Indeed's platform. So if you're hiring, stop looking for the right people and get matched with them instead at indeed.com/cycle. Before I hand back to Daniel, Francois and Richard, a quick mention for our episodes that are available for Friends of the Podcast subscribers. The latest one is the audio of last week's Kilometre Zero live event featuring Daniel and Rob Hatch. I tuned in live at the time, and very entertaining it was too. Sort of end of season feel, school's out for the winter type vibe going on as Daniel and Rob got together at the home of cycling in Mallorca. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. An annual subscription as a Friend of the Podcast will give you access to our entire back catalogue of more than 300 special episodes. And if you've not been a friend before but you'd like to give it a try, you can sign up for a month and see what it's all about. That's at thecyclingpodcast.com. There's also our regular email, the 1101 Cappuccino. You can sign up for free using Substack at thecyclingpodcast.substack.com. The emails are then delivered directly to your inbox. Over the past couple of weeks, I've written a couple of pieces. One examining the comparisons between Tadej Pogacar and Eddie Merckx. And this week, I've written a bit more of a behind the scenes at the Cycling Podcast piece about our renewed search for title sponsors to help ensure the Cycling Podcast is on the road next year and beyond. So that's the 1101 Cappuccino by the Cycling Podcast on Substack. And you can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com or thecyclingpodcast.substack.com.
So chaps, 2025 Tour de France presented today in Paris, as we've already heard. No dancing lizards, squirrels, anything like that. Just Francois and a bunch of his old his old cronies who no longer drink quite as much as they used to over dinner. But with we've been put out of our misery. We do know now what is going to face, or what the riders at 2025 Tour de France are going to face, and also the women's Tour de France, the Tour de France Femme avec Swift. I've remembered the proper name now. We'll just run over that quickly. Of course, we have a full rundown. The chaps will give us a full rundown in the Cycling Podcast Femina next episode of what's in store there, but I'll give you a quick rundown. So, 9 stages in 2025. We had 9 stages in 2024 as well, but the difference this year is that there will be 9 days next year. Of course, there was one day in 2024 when there were 2 stages. 17,240 meters altitude gain. I think that is the most to date. The race will start in Vannes in Brittany. First couple of days look pretty punchy, Francois, on paper. Some familiar climbs there from both Tours de France of yore and races like the GP West France. No time trial. The middle of the week is a bit of a traverse of the sort of bread basket, the middle of France, a couple of sprint stages in there. Thursday and Friday, we've got moyenne montagne stages, medium mountain stages. Saturday and Sunday, so the last 2 stages are summit finishes. The Saturday stage will finish on the Col de la Madeleine, and the Sunday stage, the final stage, in the hope, expectation, well, hope I think more than expectation, that we have a finale as close as the one we had this year. The finish will be at Châtel. Chaps, any quick thoughts on the route?
Yeah, Jouplan on the last. Obviously, when I looked at the course, and maybe the same applies to the men's routes. Starting from Vannes up to the mountains, you have the impression that it's mainly flat terrain, but maybe that's misleading. That's not as flat as we believe. The elevation in some of the stages is pretty high. So yeah, there might be, and also. So they've been, since the start of the Tour de France Femme avec Zwift, that there's always been a huge climb on the menu, and this time is Jouplan on the last day, which, as we know, is one of the hardest climbs in France. So that's probably where the most of the action will take place. It might be a little bit difficult. The problem we had maybe with the first editions of the Tour de France avec Zwift is that the big climb made the difference in most of the other editions. This time it's probably a little bit more balanced, and I'm really looking forward to, 2 things. One more day, because 10 days would be ideal, and even more. I mean, if they can go to 3 weeks, why not one day? And the other things is I would really, really love to see a kind of women's monument to appear, as the history of the Tour Féminin unfolds. A climb that becomes the place where women's cycling is,
You mean a sort of souvenir des granges or something like that?
Yes, something that might be, because for the time being, during the Tour presentation, I found, and that was my impression, that there are still too many references to men's Tour.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. Agreed. And I'd of course it's normal, but I'd like as gears go, I would really love to see the history of the Tour Féminin come of age and write its own history with its own places, its own legend. And I'm maybe impatient, we're not there yet, but hopefully we're going there.
Yeah, I would agree. I think sort of repetition would probably serve them quite well, Francois, over the first, the first sort of 15 years of this event's life. If instead of going to Alpe d'Huez, for example, Alpe d'Huez, it gave it that incredible finale last year. But if they were to settle on one climb and say, right, we're going to create this myth, we're going to create this icon, and it's a climb that is either not featured in the men's Tour de France or is kind of a not a significant climb in men's cycling history, but that is going to be the place for the Tour de France fam. I agree with you.
Well, perhaps even, although it doesn't really count for much in terms of the outcome of the race, or at least not anymore, the Tour's always had that Paris finale that just sort of ties things together and helps root it in the geography of France, doesn't it? And I think maybe that would help the Tour fam is to have that sort of consistent finish, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. With only a week, it's they don't feel as though they can afford that last procession, I guess, that last day. But yeah, it's certainly, well, it's very different from the men's Tour, isn't it, in the sense that we generally expect it to be decided on the last day. Chaps, on to the men's 2025 Tour de France. It will measure 3,320 kilometres. We believe there are going to be 51,550 metres of climbing, which is about average for the last few years. I think maybe it's very heavily concentrated in the second half, but about average. I'm going to go through it week by week, or we are going to go through it week by week, chaps. More or less week by week. I propose that I just tell us what the stages are until stage 8, which is the end of the north, really, I would say. Certainly the end of the Normandy and Brittany swing after the sort of Calais, Nord de Calais, sort of swing. So first 8 stages as follows. Stage 1, L'Île de Lille, features the Mont Cassel, which is a well-known climb, particularly from the 4 days of Dunkirk. A sprinter should win, we think, that day. So first yellow jersey to a sprinter. Second stage, Loire Planck to Loire. Is that how you pronounce it, François?
I don't know the place. It's probably Loin, yeah, because Loin. In the north,
yeah.
Yeah, in the north you pronounce the W oua, where in the other parts of France you pronounce it V. So it's probably Loin.
Loin Planck to Boulogne-sur-Mer. 3 steep climbs in the last 10 kilometers. Peter Sagan won in Boulogne-sur-Mer the last time the Tour visited in 2012. I think it's going to be the same finish line uphill. Stage 3, Mont Cassel again, features once again, this time with 35 kilometers to go to the finish, but that is probably going to be a sprint as well. Stage 4, Amiens to Rouen. 2,000 meters of climbing in this stage. I don't know where they found those. There's a steep, there's a sort of 10%, 900 meter long ramp, 6 kilometers from Rouen. That said, the top of Rouen Cathedral Spire might just be the highest point in the first week of racing, François. 151 meters high. Used to be the tallest building in the world, Christian Prudhomme.
It used to be, yeah.
Yeah.
It used to be.
Many,
yeah.
Many moons ago. I think Burj, what's it called in Dubai? I think it's rather higher these days. Stage 5, Caen to Caen. 33 kilometers individual time trial. Fairly flat, do we think, François?
Totally flat.
Totally.
Fine. And wide roads as well. So for really for specialists, this one. Yeah.
Stage 6, Bayeux to Vire. Hilly stage through what was described in the Tour presentation as the Suisse Normande. I didn't know that Normandy had its own Switzerland. Bayeux, of course, the home of Kevin Vauquelin, as well as the famous tapestry. 3,500 meters of climbing on this day. And it's another uphill finish. 700 meters at 10.2%. We were told in the presentation as well, François, that these are roads that Guillaume Martin will know. I made a mental note to myself when I heard that to look up the name of Guillaume Martin's novel that he's just released, but I forgot to do it, François. Do you know what the name of Guillaume Martin's novel?
No, I can't remember the name of it, the title of it either.
Do you know what it's about? Is it any good?
Yeah, it's... Well, I as much as I like Guillaume Martin very much, I found his books pretty, how could I say, he wouldn't like that, but no, I have too much respect for cycling to be a cyclist myself, but I pride myself as being a writer, and as my teacher said, could do a lot better.
Tough crowd. Yeah, that reminds me of my old French teacher, Mr. Mather, who used to just put bad on people's 8 out of 20 bad. No other comments. Not on my work, on some of my classmates' work.
Of course.
Stage 7, Saint-Malo, where Mark Cavendish famously confiscated a journalist's dictaphone in 2013. I was there. That was a very funny incident. Marcel Kittel was the winner of that stage. So Saint-Malo is the start, and the route will head through what we will call Hinault country. It is the Badger, Bernard Hinault, five-time Tour champion, his 70th birthday, and the race will finish with the now time-honoured sort of circuit double ascent of the climb, Mur de Bretagne. It's not Mur as in wall. A lot of people make this mistake when the race comes around. Mur de Bretagne is actually the name of the village, and there happens to be a climb just the other side of the village that is a bit like a wall. Prudhomme called it the Breton Alpe d'Huez, really squinting, I think, in the presentation. I imagine, so that concludes. Oh no, I said I was going to do to stage 8. Stage 8 is Saint-Mé-le-Grand to Laval. That's a flat stage. Laval is where Pogacar won a time trial in 2021. And Saint-Mé-le-Grand is where Lucien Bobé was born. And that was 100 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, François.
Yep. There's lots of anniversaries. I can go through them if you want, because as Richard noticed before we started the pod, it's a parcours looking to the past, and Christian Prudhomme was really very keen on reminding us that it's been 40 years since a Frenchman last won the Tour de France. It was Bernard Hinault. It'll be 70th birthday. We'll go through Dunkirk, and I think it's the 70th anniversary of the creations of the Dunkirk 4 days. What else? 50 years of the maillot à pois, polka dot jersey. 50 years of the white jersey. I'm probably forgetting a few, but there's lots of things to celebrate. In this parcours,
François, just looking at the first week in general, I imagine Jean-Marie Leblanc, the old Tour de France director, watching on contentedly, getting quite excited, maybe even slightly aroused at the sight of this first week. I also imagine sort of Christian Prudhomme, and I think he even made reference to this in some of the interviews he gave in the Palais des Congrès after the presentation, that they'd had to search out every possible climb they could find. I sort of imagine Christian Prudhomme sort of, I don't know, standing atop the Mont Cassel with a telescope, scouring the northern French landscape for any kind of climb that they could possibly put into the route.
Yeah, well, two things about that. Yeah, when you look at the map, you know, without knowing the climbs and you know, you think this is a Jean-Marie Leblanc Tour de France. Well, reminder, Jean-Marie Leblanc used to organize Tour de France with a full week and sometimes 10 days of flatland and, sprinters winning everything, Mario Cipollini or Jean-Paul Van Poppel. So it looks on paper like this, but you can tell that Christian Prudhomme, knowing that everybody would say, this is a Jean-Marie Leblanc type of Tour de France, as you said, tried everything he could with Thierry Gouvenou to change that. And actually, the Norman part of the of this first week is actually Thierry Gouvenou's homeland as well. So obviously, Gouvenou knows every little climb, every little redard, as I say, every little wall, every little hill, and so they really looked for this type of climbs to make it like you mentioned the Suisse Normande stage, which is actually it's the real name of the region, you know, because it's bumpy, it kind of looks a little bit like Switzerland, very green. And,
you're really squinting now. Switzerland. Which part of Switzerland? The northern suburbs of Basel.
No, not at all. It's really very bumpy, and it's not the high mountains, of course, but it's more what you find in Valais or near outside Lausanne or in this sort of places. It is quite like this. I mean, Swiss, since from the French point of view, stops in Lausanne, and then it's Germany or something. Anyways, the elevation in that stage is pretty high. It's above 3,000 meters. So they really looked for this sort of climb. And last little comment I can make about it, it's become really, really trendy. I think actually the Vuelta started the trend. They're really looking to finish the stages uphill as much as they can. Any town that has like a 1K hill is kind of almost 100% certain that the finish of the stage will be held there, because they want the famous baroudeur or punchers to win and not the pure sprinters. So they did that. I don't know. It might be more exciting than we think. We'll see.
Richard,
well, a few points that my sort of slightly doing a bit of geographic digging. I was wondering why on earth the tour was going to, what was it, Loing-Planck, like a sort of anonymous suburb of Lens or Douai or somewhere in the north, absolutely nowhere in particular. But our mate Christian Poiret, Mr. Party of the North, he was mayor there, which explains why, apparently. And it's now home to a massive Amazon fulfillment warehouse, as far as I can tell, and that's about it. But there's a lot to like there. There's a really good little museum in to Louis-en-Bobé in Saint-Mé-en-le-Grand. One of those places where you might stumble across it on a midweek lunchtime, and you'd be the only one there, and you'd have the whole place to yourself. It's really kind of just one of those beautiful little nowhere towns in France. I stumbled across it when I was cycle touring a few years ago, and I didn't even know it was there, but just wandered in. And I think I said this about this year's tour. I really like these stages that just, the interest is there if you look for it. You don't need those big Hollywood climbs or famous mountains or sort of showstopper attractions. That's what I like about the tour.
Yeah. One thing that does worry me about this first week, chaps, is the likelihood, probability of crashes. I think it could be a really, really chaotic first week, particularly with, sprinters going for that first yellow jersey, and just the nature of the roads in the north, the likelihood of
no cobbles.
Bad weather. Cobbles either. No, there are no cobbles. And the other thing that strikes me is that one sort of theme, and realistically, we know that the Tour de France route is designed largely, Francois, how many months in advance? It's over a year, isn't it, in a lot of cases?
Yeah, 18 months, yeah. I should think.
So some of the sort of backdrop to this 2025 Tour de France could have been, how do we pog-proof the route? And we'll come on to talk a bit more about this maybe later. But looking at that first week and what you just said, Francois, about the uphill finishes, it strikes me that there are, Boulogne-sur-Mer is definitely an opportunity. I think Rouen could even be an opportunity. I mentioned that 10% 900 meter ramp, 6 kilometers from Rouen. Maybe that sounds a little bit more like the Calais stage that Wout van Aert won a couple of years ago. But then the Vier stage, 3,500 meters of climbing with 700 meters at 10% to finish. Another opportunity potentially for Pogacar. Plus the Caen time trial, 33 kilometers flat. But yeah, we could potentially be looking at 2 or 3 Pogacar stage wins if it's the same Pogacar that rocked up to this year's Tour de France. Should we move on to the second week? Stage
maybe
9. Sorry, go on,
maybe,
François.
Just maybe a quick one about the time trial. I didn't check, to be honest, but 33 Ks, all flat. It's been quite a while. We didn't have such a long, flat time trial for specialists early in the tour. I can't seem to... Well, they were Laval a few years ago, but it was not that long, I don't think. So we might... Well, it might lead a few riders like Ghana or, the real specialists to go to the tour just for that. I don't know. It might be one of the attractions. That's all I wanted to add.
So, stage 9, Chinon to Châteauroux. As I said earlier, could be a bit of a snooze fest. We might be saved by the wind. And that is the scene of two Mark Cavendish stage wins, 2008, and maybe even three, actually. I think it's three.
Three.
Yeah, 2008. I forget the middle one. Renshaw was involved. It may have been 2011, yeah. And then the most recent one, of course, 2021. As I said earlier, I don't expect him to be there, certainly not with Lycra on. So that is stage 9. Stage 10 is Enusa to Le Mont d'Or. 4,400 meters of climbing. It's Bastille Day. 7 climbs of more than 3 kilometers. So a very lumpy day indeed. Stage 11, Toulouse. 8 kilometers from the finish that day, there is a steep ramp of a few hundred meters. Another one of those. Stage 12 goes from Auch to Hautacam via the cols de Soulor, Bordère, and the final climb to Hautacam. Of course, that climb synonymous with Bjarne Riis in 1996. I'm sure ASO will love us for reminding people of that. Vincenzo Nibali in 2014, Vingegaard in 2014. Oh, and I've omitted Juan José Cobo, another one that... holds a special place in the heart of the Tour de France organisers in 2008. So that's the first difficult day in the Pyrenees. Stage 13, Ludonvier to Peyragudes. 11 kilometres, all uphill. It's a time trial. The first genuine... We've had a lot of time trials in the mountains featuring parts of mountain climbs. Of course, the most sort of famous one in recent years in 2023 where Jonas Vingegaard trounced Tadej Pogacar, but we haven't had one that has just consisted of a climb, a sort of alpine or Pyrenean climb for quite a while, I don't think. Most recent winners at Peyragudes, Tadej Pogacar a couple of years ago, and Romain Bardet before him. Stage 14, this is probably the one that's attracted the most sort of attention for historic reasons. Stage 14, Port to Super Bagnères, just under 5,000 meters of climbing with the Tourmalet, the Aspin, and the Peyresourde. 36 years, isn't it, since Super Bagnères' last inclusion. Very famous, Francois, isn't it, for a stage in 1986. You're going to have to remind me whether that was pre-FT's tour career, was it? Was that the year before you started?
That was my first. That was my first stage on the Tour de France.
So, very famous. Yeah. Very, very famous. Because the previous day, stage 2, from Bayonne to Pau, Bernard Hinault, who had normally come into the Tour de France supporting his teammate, Greg LeMond, purporting to support, and what a sentence, him. He attacked 90 kilometers from the finish, gained 4.5 minutes on LeMond, and, well, surprised everyone, didn't he? And then the following day, on the stage to Super Bagnères, what did Hinault do? Well, he attacked again. Again, I think it was around 90 kilometers from the finish. At one stage, he had two minutes plus advantage over Le Monde. It looked as though the tour was possibly over at that point. But then the Badger kind of faded, didn't he? Well, he faded pretty badly. Before, in fact, on the Peyresourde and then on the final climb to Super Bagnères. And LeMond claim back some time. And, well, that was the sort of second chapter in this fantastic battle that was documented. Again, I'll mention Richard Moore in his book, Slaying the Badger, and has been documented in various other places. One of the great sort of Tour de France duels, a sort of civil war between Le Monde and Hinault La Vie Claire. And Super Bagnard, also featured in 1989, another Tour de France, of course, famous for a duel featuring Greg LeMond. That one's LeMond and Fignon. And it was Robert Miller, another rider who, of course, Richard chronicled his career. Richard chronicled in another great book, In Search of Robert Miller, that he was the winner in 1989. But François Super Bagnard has not featured since. And I learned today, reading L'Équipe, this has largely been because of a bridge, or the absence of a bridge. A new bridge needed to be built to accommodate heavy goods vehicles, the whole sort of heavy goods vehicles that take things like barriers and gantries up to the finish at Tour de France stages. That's why it's not featured. And this new, well, a new bridge has been constructed. Hence, the Tour de France can go back there. There's also a nice new cable car, I believe, that takes only 8 minutes and will be transporting fans, journalists, and anyone else who wants to go up from Luchon. And that's not quite the end of week two. There's another stage, sort of transitional stage from Muret to Carcassonne. Transitional if it's not windy, that is. But going back, François, to Super Bagnard. Excited to see that back.
Yeah, and it sums up what we already said. It's when you look at the roots of this year's tour, the 2024 tours, you had the Chemin Blanc, you had the gravel, you had finishing Nice. I mean, you had lots of innovations. It was kind of a maverick route, very remote from a classic traditional Tour de France parcours. This is back to really back to traditional tour. We know that Christian Prudhomme loves his history of the tour. He was really happy to have the Puy de Dôme back. And as you said, for the Puy de Dôme, some works needed to be done and some arrangements needed to be done. And I'm sure that Christian grew up watching these races, and he was already a journalist at the time of the 1986 Tour de France. Because we were in the same, as I said many times, we were at school together. But obviously he wanted this back, So we were in Hinault land in the first week. We'll be back in Hinault land in a way in Super Bagnard. And I must say it's part of the tour tradition. I was mentioning the fact that I would like a women's monument to emerge, but there are names of climbs like this, like Super Bagnard, that that ring bells in the mind of the fan, and cycling, like most sports, is a lot about history and memories, and so obviously to see a new big battle between hopefully two or three riders up Super Bagnard will be really exciting. So another thing which is obvious from what we said before, but it's been a very long time since the first mountain stage is on day nine. In previous years, there was always this attempt to put a little bit of mountain in the first
12, week. Stage 12, François. The first stage in the Pyrenees is stage 12.
Yeah, sure, but you had Mont-d'Or, puis de Sancy, which is already kind of a mountain stage. But to have either the Pyrenees or the Alps only on day 12, I think it's pretty unusual as well. So there'll be real excitement from to be back in the Pyrenees, as you say. Also, it's an uphill time trial, a real mountain time trial. The last I remember was probably L'Alpe d'Huez with Armstrong.
I think so.
And these kind of these kind of stages remind me of Lucien Van Nimpt and this, or Pedro Delgado. At the time, you had this kind of so that's also return to tradition after last year's tour, which was kind of revolutionary would be a little bit too much. But yeah, we're back to the tour history there.
Are there any other climbs you can think of that there's been this sort of similar clamour to bring back? Because there's been talk or sort of a bit of a wish for Super Bagnères to come back as a, like bring it back from the 80s, so to speak. And I can't really think of anywhere else that has a similar
There are a few. I mean, Val Thorens, François, Val Thorens.
I think we've been back to Val Thorens, haven't we?
I always get it mixed up with the Granon.
No, because we went back to Granon, we went back to Val Thorens on that, in 2019, I think we were supposed to.
Did we go all the way back there? We didn't go to because there is a road. There's a point on the road that's well above 2,000 meters, isn't there? And maybe it didn't go to. We didn't go all the way to the top.
No, we probably didn't go all the way.
Yeah, I mean, just you asking me that question, Richard, was, you know, I was thinking actually amid all this kind of, you know, interest and sort of nostalgia around Super Bagnères, you know, it's for those of us, and we are a bit of a niche, who are interested in the history of professional cycling, you know, it's nice, it kind of rings bells, it sort of is, you know, it gives us a bit of a warm, fuzzy feeling, but it really, you know, that expires pretty quickly, doesn't it? It ends up just being, you know, it's a sort of 17-kilometer climb or whatever it is at 7%. I mean, I understand. So I've never been up to Super Bagnères. I've done the first part of the road. I understand there is a really beautiful sort of panoramic section. The last kind of 2 kilometers, or certainly the way it was described in L'Equipe this morning, made it sound really panoramic. But beyond, as I say, the sort of great reveal of, oh yes, we're going back there, it doesn't really change much, does it? And I think, I suppose the ultimate kind of Emperor's New Clothes moment for me, and you've already mentioned the climb, François, the Puy de Dôme a couple of years ago was a huge disappointment, anticlimax as far as I was concerned. And that's an unusual climb with unusual circumstances because there are no fans there. And I just thought that it really fell flat. I don't feel, I hope the tour doesn't feel any great compulsion to go back there any time soon.
Well, for a time trial, it would be great to have a time trial up Le Puy de Dôme. That might be interesting. But apart from that, I agree with you. You're right. Super Bagnères is not super hard. You know, it probably won't be the decisive stage. I mean, Otakam is much harder. The uphill time trial is probably harder as well. Le Col de la Loz in the third week will get to there. Even though it's not the steepest side, are probably more deciding than Super Bagnères. But I mean, I'm the old man here, so I have to be nostalgic about it. And I'm sure that there's still a vast, you know, portion of tour fans who are aging, and it's still a reminder, especially as Le Monde and Hino are still around, and you can be sure there'll be interviews and coverage of the old images, and it's always fun to because we saw that at the tour presentation to look at those old, you know, images, and the way the jerseys were, the way the bikes were, the way the crowd was behaving, and it's part of the tour, you know.
Yeah.
It's
I'm not sure it resonates with a young audience, really. I look at it through the completely selfish prism of, oh, that's gonna be that's great because I can get a story out of that. I can do a feature on that. and there's an awful lot of that in this Tour de France. It's certainly fertile for, you know, color writers, reporters. So I'm grateful to Christian Prudhomme for that.
That is sort of the point, isn't it, as well?
That's the most important thing, isn't it?
And I think the thought that came to me with when the camera would pan, wouldn't it, in the Palais des Congrès to, you know, there's Bernard Hinault, and then there's Bernard Thévenet, and, well, Mark Cavendish now, I suppose he's sort of crossed the divide, hasn't he, to retired riders, even if he doesn't want to explicitly say so yet. But the way that the mountains are presented, and certainly with Super Bagnères, it's a little bit like revisiting old friends, isn't it? Or characters from the past and sort of reliving those memories. And I think more so than actually during the race, it's at this big reveal when these places have the most sort of human character to them. that we start to tell stories about them, and you know, they kind of have that personality again, don't they? And yeah, it's Super Bagnères isn't the most scenic, is it? But it's kind of peculiar. I don't know how much you remember François from 86, but there's not really anything there, is there, except for that huge sort of edifice of that hotel.
It's like a
hospice, up there,
isn't there? Yeah,
yeah, yeah, enormous big grey, yeah, block of a hotel, and that's kind of it. It's sort of too low to get snow, I think, reliably these days, at least.
Yeah, that's right. Well, most of the Pyrenees ski resorts, actually, the resort is down the downhill. It's down the it's Luchon, or you know, it's and up in the mountains. You only have a couple of hotels, and it's the same with Peyragudes. They're not unlike La Plagne, where we're going as well, which is a real ski resort with lots of hotels and stuff, which is kind of L'Alpe d'Huez. You know, again, I hate La Plagne. It's a dreadful place, to be honest, but and I, as you know, I hate the Alps generally. Oh, yeah. But no, you're right. It's I don't think it's a very super hard climb, and yeah, it's really the Pyrenees type of ski resorts. Nothing really up there to see, to be honest. And it might be a problem to get down from it for you guys.
Yeah, there's that cable car to
yeah. I will. Yeah, that's right. And I'm not taking cable cars either because I'm afraid of heights. That's great that I can't go.
Yeah, talking about nostalgia, that day I will be reminded of Thierry Gouvenou's fabled grid start of 3 or 4 years ago, more like seven or eight years ago, because that that is the road out of Luchon that they will take to go to Super Bagnères, where we had the famous, wonderful, innovative, revolutionary grid start a few years ago.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by a map.
Hello, Lionel here again to tell you about our clothing partners, MAP. Founded in Melbourne, of course, they've since exported their style and ethos to cyclists all around the world. And MAP continues to innovate and reinvent itself. Recently, there's been a revamp for the Alt Road range, which blends comfort, durability, practicality and style all into one. If you're riding off the beaten track or spending a long time in the saddle, the Alt Road collection is your starting point for garments that are breathable and natural, perfect for the elements, and have increased storage capacity, which is a fancy way for saying that they've got lots of pockets so you can take all your stuff with you when you're going on a ride. If you're more likely to stick to the road, the training range for both men and women have been updated with a great array of distinctive colours. And there's been a refresh too for the Evade X range, my personal favourite, combining peak performance, ultra lightweight materials and MAP's trademark bold graphic design. Finally, a little bit of news, because one of MAP's privateer riders, Rosa Closer, who won the women's race at Unbound this year, is going to turn professional on the road with Canyon SRAM next season. She'll still be racing gravel as a privateer, but it completes a rapid journey into the pro ranks for the German rider, because as recently as 2020, she was commuting in Copenhagen when her town bike was stolen, and noticing that other people were getting about and reaching their destination more quickly on a road bike, she decided to replace her town bike with a road bike and really got bitten by the competitive bug from that point on. It wasn't long before she was doing her first local race, in April 2022, in fact. And this season, she's been racing gravel as one of MAP's privateers. She also has her own jersey design at map.cc, which is worth checking out. Have a look at everything MAP has to offer on the website, map.cc. I can't guarantee that you'll be less than a year away from securing a pro contract like Rosa if you pull on a MAP jersey, but you will definitely look and feel the part.
Chaps, I'm going to rattle through the last week, and then we'll just give our overall thoughts on, you know, how it sort of all shakes out. Stay 16, Montpellier. So this is the other side of the rest day now. The rest day will be in Montpellier, the second rest day. Montpellier to the Mont Ventoux. First time since 2016 when Chris Froome did his Eliud Kipchoge impression. This is what they call nowadays an unipuerto, single climb, sort of hockey stick profile. No climbs before the Ventoux, which will be climbed from Bédouin. Stage 17, Bolène to Valence, another transition stage, probably a sprint. It could, however, be windy. It'll be that awful finish line, François, outside Valence, which is nowhere near the picturesque centre of Valence. It's sort of outside a Monsieur Bricolage and a Castorama. Stage 18 from Vif to Col de la Loz, featuring the climbs of the Glandon, very difficult Glandon, the Madeleine, and the Col de la Loz via Courchevel this time, which is the other side to what was used 2 years ago, and prior to that what was used in 2020, wasn't it? This, I think most people would agree, is the Queen Stage, 5,500 metres of climbing, and the Col de la Loz will be the highest point of the tour. Stage 19, Albertville to La Plagne, 4,600 metres of climbing, calls of the Saisie, the Col du Pré, which is a sort of hillary step before the Cormet de Roseland, which the Col du Pré summits and goes down a tiny bit to the big reservoir, the Roseland reservoir, and then up again to the Cormet de Roseland. And the finish will be at La Plagne, which is a very long climb, 19 kilometers at 7.2%. Stage 20, Nantois to Pontarlier, 2,850 meters of climbing, and features a climb, quite a hard climb early on in the stage where Jonas Vingegaard dropped everyone in the 2023 Dauphiné. I expected a little bit more from this stage. I haven't got the profile yet, but you can sort of see that it's going to be quite hilly, but I sort of expected something a bit more like what we've seen often on the penultimate stages of the Vuelta in the last few years, like the one in Galicia when Superman Lopez famously got off his bike, a sort of last chance saloon kind of day where if there was the time gaps in the general classification were pretty narrow, there might be the opportunity for someone to sort of upset the apple cart. I don't think that's the case. I think it's going to be a pretty routine breakaway day. And then stage 21 is the usual procession to Paris. Chaps, last week, a lot of attention, obviously, for those big mountain stages, Col de la Loz, La Plagne. The one thing that really strikes me about the mountain stages in this Tour de France, every single one of them, all six of them, summit finishes, which I don't necessarily love. Francois, I was going to ask you, has there been any talk? Have you heard any talk? There have been murmurings in the last 3 or 4 years, particularly after the Gino Maeder tragedy, that downhill finishes or any mountain stages that don't finish on top of climbs are to be, limited. Have you heard any talk about that being the reason why we've got six summit finishes?
Actually, no. I didn't have any. I didn't chat with Christian Prudhomme or Thierry Gouvenou about it. I'm sure it is an issue. I mean, safety is one of the major concerns. We're not finishing on Col de la Loz. We're finishing in Châtel. So that's. No. I'm talking about Jouplan. The one from Jouplan to Châtel, there is a. No, but that's the women. In the women's, there's kind of a descent there to go to Châtel. Well, it's not so hard as remember that stage was Bob Bungels won on the men's tour. But that's right. There's almost no going back down that's probably. That's probably the case. I haven't asked, but that's a good point.
It is funny though, isn't it? With those six summit finishes and what I said about the first week, after a year after a season really, when sort of the biggest talking point at the end of this season is Tadej Pogacar crushing, dominating? Is he squeezing the interest out of professional cycling with his dominance? Given what we saw, and no 2 years are the same, but given what we saw in 2024 and the way, particularly in the last week, the way he really sort of rammed home his supremacy, this is a route. If you wanted to build a Tour de France to reaffirm what we saw in 2024 from Tadej Pogacar, it would be this one, wouldn't it? Six summit finishes, lots of punchy uphill finishes in the first week, and the time trialing that we've got. This is perfect for another Pogacar cakewalk, is it not?
Remember we said in, not so long ago that, that the Tour de France was not no longer decided in the climbs but in the descents. I mean that's that had been a trend, you know, in the last few Froome years and afterwards. So that, that's obviously something there. There's also something I know it's a little bit out of the, you know, it's a little bit how could I put it, not pointless, but I kind of feel a little bit sorry for all these results like La Plagne, and because we know that that alpine skiing is probably doomed to disappear, you know. So will cycling be, and Col de la Loz is an example, will cycling be the is the future of the, those places? I don't know about La Plagne, you
this
know,
is,
but
this is Francois. This is Francois dancing on the grave of the alpine economy because you hate the Alps so much.
Yeah, but La Plagne is finished. You know what's going to happen to La Plagne in the future? It was built entirely for skiing, and there's nothing else to do. It's ugly. It's you know 1970s architecture. It has nothing else to offer. I'm sorry, you guys, if you're from La Plagne.
Convert all those ski chalets into retirement homes for people like you, Francois.
Yeah, to remove us from civilization. It's an idea, to be honest. It's an idea.
Yeah, Richard.
I mean, you hit the nail on the head, I think, with Col de la Loz. That's very much like economic diversification, whatever you want to call it, for that part of the Alps. I did hear that they were building another bike path similar to Col de la Loz, but they had to reroute it because the people that were designing it weren't entirely au fait with cycling, and they just made it even harder. And Col de la Loz, the traditional, let's call it traditional in that it's been there a couple of times, but that side that we know is already pretty much at the limit for what's possible for a recreational cyclist. And so I think they've had to have a rethink. But I remember it was 2023, was it? They came down that descent that they're now going to go up from Courchevel. And that was where they trialed those huge sort of inflatable mattresses for the first time on a corner there on that bend. And I can remember sort of jogging up that side of the mountain and then jogging back down. And as I was jogging back down to see the finish, the publicity caravan, I think they just had to get rid of everything. And despite the fact that I was facing away from them and running away, they were just pelting me with stuff sort of from behind. That's my enduring memory of that climb. But it's not as hard, is it, as the Col de la Loz that we know from Miguel Angel Lopez. And who was the stage winner that day?
Felix Gal.
It's not that hard, but it's similar in that it's the gradient changes. It's fairly narrow. It's not steady. It's not your sort of ski station road like you get to La Plagne. It is sort of roller coastery. But yeah, I was scratching my head a little bit about that penultimate stage to Pontarlier and why that's there and whether there is a plan in the minds of Thierry Gouvenou and Christian Prudhomme to putting that there. Or is it literally just that geography dictates that they sort of have to go there after the mountains? Or I don't know. Without really seeing more about that stage, it's hard to tell, isn't it, whether it is the sort of hidden surprises in there or not.
It is pretty bumpy from what we saw on the tour presentation. I guess that it's a last chance for the so-called baroudeur to win a stage before Paris, and it's probably easier for the whole caravan to travel from Pontarlier to Paris than from the mountains. So there's also that logistic aspect of things. But you're right, it seems like all of a sudden we, you know, it's an last minute add-on, you know. It's strange.
Nantois, Francois, I don't know what your thoughts are on Nantois. A very strange place. I always find it a little sort of lake on the, just sort of on the edge of the Jura. It's got quite a few of its own specialities. There's a fish that A lake fish that they always serve in like a creamy sauce, which of course I never order. Yeah, I never order, but I always sort of
It's not so bad.
Yeah, I always see it arriving on people's people's dinner tables, and I'm never struck with food envy, shall we say, when that happens.
It's actually quenelle à la sauce naturelle, and quenelle is kind of a fish sausage, you know, and you put that sauce, that kind of orange sauce. It's a little bit sweet.
I'm glad you're making it sound as appetizing as it looks, François.
No, it's not so. To be honest, I don't like quenelles too much, and I don't like sauce naturelle too much, but it's not so bad. There are far worse things than that. But naturelle as a place, I mean, no, I won't say anything. There's a huge viaduct on top of it. That's the only thing I can
what
say.
What was it your French apart teacher Daniel would have said? Eight out of 20 bad.
Pontarlier, of course, very famous in the Tour de France for one of the great sort of coups, the great kind of revolutions, hold-ups in Tour de France history in 2001, my first Tour de France, under a torrential rain, a huge group got down the road, and François Simon, wasn't it, took the yellow jersey, but André Kivilev gained a lot of time, and at one stage it looked as though it was going to be pretty difficult for Lance Armstrong and Jan Ulrich to overhaul him, and Kivilev ended up André Kivilev ended up finishing fourth in that Tour de France. Chaps, I think we should probably conclude there. I mean, what else is there to say? It's a Tour de France route. There's a lot of mountains. The strongest rider is probably going to win. And we're going to visit some pretty places. We're going to have some good food, some good wine, and some pretty bad wine and bad food, I would imagine, as well. Because that's the way it goes. That's all part of the fun. François, the last note I've got written on today's my sort of prep doc is, what's happened to Corsica? Triple question mark. This was inspired by an interview Christian Prudhomme gave after the presentation today, when he was sort of boasting about the number of départements that this tour and other tours in the last... I think he has a rule, doesn't he, that in any five-year cycle, he has to, or the tour has to visit every region, or it wouldn't be every département. But he said, yes, I've managed to do that, except Corsica. And I was the one who took the tour back to Corsica in 2013. However, François, we never hear any talk about the tour going back to Corsica. And this is a great shame, because we'd all love to go to Corsica. Any murmurs about that?
Well, no. I mean, the thing is, my impression is that, you know, Christian Prudhomme is happy. He's done it once, you know, whereas the Giro often goes to Sicily. So it won't be much more difficult to go back to Corsica. Is there a financial reason for that? The thing is, these days, Corsica is run by an autonomous leader. So is it political? I don't think so. I think they would be keen to have the Tour de France back in Corsica as well. But as we saw in the last couple of years, the idea was, what I heard, and that's probably the case, usually you have Grand Départ in Sicily for the Giro, and it's pretty rare that you go in the middle of the Giro to Sicily and back, because you lose a little bit of time there. And the problem is, the reason why we had Grand Départs in towns abroad is that it's so expensive to get the Grand Départ of the Tour de France. So maybe money is involved there. And obviously, or also, I think that it's probably more profitable to go across the borders than to cross the Mediterranean to go back to Corsica. That might be one of the reasons. Another big absentee, and we all thought before the rumors started piling up about this year's tour, is L'Alpe d'Huez. We haven't been to L'Alpe d'Huez for quite a while now, and we'll see whether we go back next year. But I mean, everybody thought until 3 months ago that instead of Lapland,
I'd book my hotel, François.
Yeah. So is there a problem with L'Alpe d'Huez as well? I don't know.
Not the only faulty route link that caused some swift rebooking of hotels today, I should say. There was a phantom, this mysterious Toulouse Day suddenly appeared in the middle of what we thought was going to be the tour route, and that kind of put all of the sort of dates in the wrong place, and yeah, there's some hasty rebooking had to take place today. Anyway, chaps, unless either of you have got any more observations you'd like to add, I suggest that we conclude that there. We park the 2025 Tour de France there. I think on the Tour de France website that they were under each stage, they were telling us how many days until such and such a stage. It was about 260 something, 250 to most of them, which sort of sent a bit of a shiver down my spine, but also a bit of a frisson of excitement. Anyway, long way to go. And we'll be back next week with the first of a long series of Review of the Year episodes, which will take various forms and flavours, and going all the way, pretty much all the way until Christmas. Lastly, just like to thank everyone who attended our Kilometer Zero Live last week. That was Rob Hatch in conversation with yours truly in Mallorca. That is, or the recording of that is on the Friends of the Podcast Kilometer Zero feed now for you to listen to. We've got another one coming soon, not a Kilometer Zero Live, but a Kilometer Zero special, the class of 04, about the 20th anniversary of the British Cycling Academy starting. And that's about it, chaps. We'll be back next week. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thanks, chaps.
And thank you, Francois.
Merci à tous.
Hey, Daniel. So, yeah, the Tudor thing was, it's exciting. I'm really excited for next year. I think it'll be a really great organization to be a part of. And, yeah, they have some big goals for the future, so it's gonna be a cool year. But yeah, it was pretty last minute. So I was sitting in the hotel during the Italian races. It was maybe the Thursday before Lombardia, and one evening my phone starts ringing, and it was like a Swiss number. So, yeah, I knew I had been sort of waiting to hear from some other teams. So I was like, oh, maybe it was, you know, one of these other teams that I had been sort of discussing a little bit with. And, yeah, I picked up the phone, and it was Raphael Meyer, the boss of Tudor. And, yeah, he asked me if I had some time to chat. So he sort of explained to me So I had actually emailed him earlier in the year, and yeah, I didn't actually hear back. He contacted me a few months later. He said that actually they were initially full. They had only planned to take 29 riders, but they saw nearing the end of the year that a lot of their guys were pretty dead, and doing a full calendar was a lot more challenging than they had anticipated. So they realized that, you know, sticking to only 29 probably would be a bit challenging, and they needed someone, yeah, who I guess had some experience, could do a full program, and yeah, was sort of robust, you know, and not like a young guy who, you know, maybe wouldn't be able to do as many days of racing or be as consistent over the course of the year. So they sort of said they wanted someone who was really consistent with experience and things like that. And so that's cool, because that kind of fit my profile. He asked me if I was free. So the day after, they came and picked me up at the hotel. We went for a coffee. The boss of the team, Raphael, and their head sports director, Ricardo Scheidecker. And so, yeah, I had a coffee with them. It was a nice chat. And, yeah, they said, okay, well, they're not 100% sure they were going to sign another guy, but they'd think about, or, you know, they were going to discuss it, and they would probably decide by Monday. So, anyway, Monday comes around. And, you know, obviously then you're, like, kind of really waiting and, you know, hoping things are going to work out. And Monday comes around, and I didn't get any phone calls, so I was like, oh, that's a bit too bad. But, you know, I guess I'm sort of used to these things by now. then we were about to go to dinner with some friends, some other pro cyclists in Nice. And just as we were walking out to the car, it's like 7. And, you know, normally my girlfriend and I are pretty late for everything that we do. And this time we were actually going to be on time, so we were pretty happy about it. But literally as we were about to step into the car, my phone rings and it's another Swiss number, but it wasn't the boss. So I was like, oh, well, okay, who's this? So I pick up the phone and it was Fabian Cancellara. And yeah, he just wanted to talk with me about, yeah, how I saw things and explain to me a bit more about the team and their ideas. And so that was really cool. So it was nice to have a chat with him. And yeah, so ended up being late for dinner, but that was okay. It was a good call to get, and I was happily late. And yeah, then things progressed quite quickly from there. You know, I spoke to some other people on the team, and then yeah, I think the following Wednesday they asked me if I wanted to join the team. So that was really cool. And yeah, so that's how it happened. So it was pretty quick, and yeah, I'm actually really excited because it is an organization that I've been watching for a bit of time. You know, I've sort of seen they've been growing quite quickly, and I had heard, you know, that they had really big plans, and yeah, they seem just super professional and motivated, and you know, everyone I spoke to really enjoys being a part of the team, from the riders to the staff. And so yeah, it seems like a really cool project and yeah, organization, and one that really wants to grow and progress. And yeah, that's something that I'm excited to, yeah, to take part of. And you know, they have a lot of young riders in addition to, yeah, some really big leaders for next year. So yeah, I think I can play an important role in, you know, helping all those guys, you know, whether it's the he or she's or Alaphilippe's trying to win some big races, some classics, maybe some grand tour stages, or the young guys who, yeah, I think probably have a lot of potential and just, yeah, have a bit to learn. So I'm really excited to be a part of it, and I think it's going to be a great year next year. And yeah, thanks everyone for your support along the way and following along. So still here, guys. Good stories to come. Ciao.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
From the office to a first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation. But clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They combine timeless style with modern performance materials to keep you looking good and feeling comfortable all day, no matter what's on today's agenda. Browse everything from shorts and polos to sweats and crews. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.